Hello, and welcome back to the Future Car Podcast from Siemens Digital Industry Software. I'm your host, Connor Pike. Today, in the final episode of our Transportation Revolution series, Nand and I are going to take a closer look at autonomous vehicle development around the automotive industry. We begin by discussing the different levels of autonomy as they are defined by the SAE, and how vehicle capabilities change at each level. Then we talk about AV verification, testing, and validation, which is one of the most critical aspects of AV development. Finally, I ask Nand about how companies are pushing the boundaries of AV development, the role of city infrastructure in their deployment, and the importance of AVs to new shared mobility models. So please enjoy.
All right, so Nand, to start off our discussion of autonomous vehicles and autonomous drive, of course, could you just give an overview of the different levels of autonomy and where we're at on the spectrum right now?
Yeah, sure. As you know, there's five levels of vehicle autonomy in terms of the SAE definition. Level zero is no automation, but level one is what we call driver assistant system. And the level two is partial automation, in which you can do, let's say, the steering and the braking functions together. And by now, majority of the OEMs have matured to that point that they are offering SAE level two. So the examples from a usage standpoint would be lane centering or lane departure warning, doing some steering functions related to that. And the example in the braking would be autonomous emergency braking or the adaptive cruise control, which most vehicles have today. So to my experience, that level of SAE level of autonomous maturity is out there. Now, next comes the SAE level three, which is the conditional automation scenario, where you also have the environmental detection capabilities. In other words, you have the mapping function, and then you can take a car or a vehicle from point A to point B, and now you've matured it to level three, but you still need a human override. So a lot of the companies are offering different versions, different levels, and level three is the most confusing because there's so many scenarios that they allow you to operate, but they want hands on the wheel all the time, or they're doing a face recognition and looking at the driver. So the driver needs to be attentive. You can't go to sleep or reading a book, as an example. The level three, that's what's called the conditional automation. So we are in that journey right now. A lot of the companies transitioning into level three. They are claiming these are the level three vehicles, and they've got certain scenarios up to some extent offering those. And the next level is the level four, which is high automation, where you can truly do these functions I talked about, but you still a human override is still an option. So in other words, and a vehicle is confused about something, it'll give the warnings, and then human intervention is required. That's the level four. And then level five becomes the ultimate, where you have no constraints. There's no geofencing. There are no conditions. You can work in all operating conditions, whether it's weather, day, night, etc. That's the full automation SAE level five. So which is, in my mind, far out, further out than any of the other levels. So those are the high-level definitions of SAE level zero to five.
And then maybe just as an example, I'm sure pretty much everyone is familiar with Tesla's autopilot system, and there are competitors coming out for that as well. But where would that fit on the scale?
That will be in that level three category talked about. And then, every OEM might have a different conditions for other reasons, for legal as well as for what's required by law in different countries. What the driver scenario is, the warning systems are, whether they allow them to keep hands on the wheel all the time. I have driven some vehicles where you can take your hands off for a few seconds and then you get a warning that puts your hands back on the vehicle.
So you just mentioned when you were describing the level five, you talked about different weather conditions and then, of course, driving in the day versus the night. I know most people understand is quite a different task. That kind of brings up that I think one of the most difficult parts of validating an autonomous vehicle is just the sheer number of different scenarios that one might encounter out on public roads. So then how can a passenger, or for that matter, a company, be confident that the vehicle will be able to perform safely and comfortably at all times, given these just the multitude of different scenarios it might encounter?
Yeah, and you're definitely, you're right on that. It's a daunting task of all the possible scenarios. And no matter how many scenarios you imagine, there could be still some what we call the corner cases you might find that you haven't thought about or the systems haven't thought about. And that's where I think the simulation technology comes into play, that instead of relying on a purely only physical testing of all these scenarios, that might not even be possible. And over the years, there's been several studies which say how many years it'll take and how many millions of miles you'll have to do a validation testing if it was a physical only, that companies are adapting and the technology companies, including Siemens, is offering solutions in the simulation world where you can create these scenarios and create what's called the edge cases, the things you haven't thought about. And that's where the other technologies like machine learning and artificial intelligence are coming into play to create those scenarios. So in that case, you run your vehicle during the development cycle through those scenarios in a virtual environment. And that's the best way you can do in terms of assuring that you accounted for maximum number of scenarios possible in that given condition. So simulation plays a big role in that autonomous. Okay. To the extent that I can pretty much say that, having done simulation for over 30 years, that it's not even possible without simulation when it comes to the autonomous or the ADAS vehicle development.
Interesting. And is anyone taking a purely simulation approach, or usually it's a hybrid kind of between simulation and physical testing?
The big challenge in simulation is that at the end of the day, people don't buy virtual models and they don't drive. They drive real products, whether it's a truck, right, or cars or whatever. So I think the key thing is the correlation of a physical test and the virtual test, right? And if they're correlated, that's where you build your confidence. In Siemens terms, we call them digital twin, right? And the industry also is getting very popular on digital twin. But what we do is the most comprehensive digital twin of performance, that what you get a performance level, which is physics-based, in a virtual environment, you can get the same performance in the physical test. And once they are correlated, that's how you build confidence. And then you can start relying on more and more on the simulation or the virtual testing. And then there are several other scenarios in between that it's always a hybrid in the sense that you can bring a hardware in the loop, whether it's starting from scratch, developing a chip or a systems on a chip to a level, a full vehicle. And you can have a vehicle in the loop systems as well. So you're right. It's a hybrid because of getting that correlation and building the confidence.
And then how do you see that balance between the physical and the virtual testing? How do you see the balance evolving moving forward? Is it leaning further into the virtual testing, or is it staying pretty pretty even on either side?
I don't know. I think it is growing quite a bit in the virtual environment. Okay. Because in addition to some of the scenarios are not even possible in the physical testing environment. Let's say if you want to do a car stopping when a pedestrian is crossing the road in a physical test environment, to have that set up, it is a tremendous amount of investments in the prototypes as well as in the pedestrian systems as an example. In the virtual environment, you've got initial investment, but after that, you can run all these iterations in a very, very economical way that it's real, and you can use that for production. So there's more opportunities, more growth going on in the virtual environment, in the simulation environment, in my mind. But of course, at the same time, the physical side of the business is maturing so that they can keep up to date what's being done in the virtual environment. And then the correlation happens because at the end of the day, certification is still a physical testing based for most parts of the world. So we do need to do the validation and certification as a final run. So I think one of the ways you do that is you want to make sure your first time through physical testing is a success, and you run all these scenarios in a virtual environment to play those scenarios so you have a very high success rate in a physical test environment. Is a good way to balance that.
So you're using the virtual to prepare yourself for the physical test.
That's right.
So then stepping back somewhat from the level five autonomy, today already there's a large number of assistance systems available. You mentioned the lane keeping assistance and the automated emergency braking. And as we see a greater number of these systems become available, we've also seen a lot of additional regulations come out. So then I suppose, what do you see as the effect of these new regulations on the future of vehicle validation and certification?
So the future regulations have to take into account the maturing technologies. So today, for example, in safety, there's a well-established, and I'll use the U.S. example again, NHTSA, National Highway of Traffic Safety Administration, what the protocol is for those testing. And then in addition to that, they also have the rating system where they give vehicles 1 to 5-star ratings from a passive safety performance. And that's where your airbags, seatbelts, performance, et cetera, comes into play. The regulations are starting to mature, that they've started to take into account the active safety features and how they play in the car, and those contribute towards the safety ratings as a good example, that regulations are adapting and maturing. But to best of my knowledge, today there is no test procedures declared, which will be accepted for a pure autonomous vehicle running. So there's a lot of work to be done in addition to the technology side, both on the regulation and the legislation front. Policymakers, a lot of work is still needed to be done in that arena.
And then in the development of these systems, these ADAS systems, how can companies find a balance between proving safety and compliance and meeting these regulatory requirements and also satisfying the business challenges, you know, wanting to produce a high quality, profitable product?
Yeah, so there's parts of it. If you look, what are the key components of making a ADAS features and autonomous vehicles? You can have an analogy of a human body. So there's the eyes or the perceiving side of it, which is camera, LiDARs, radars. They are bringing in the signals through the sensors. And then you have a processing of that information, which is the equivalent of, let's say, brains for a driver, human driver in the car. And for that, you have several algorithms and the computing environment in the vehicle, or it could be on the cloud, to make those decisions, what to do with those scenarios. And the third part is the commanding as a based on that scenario, what do you want a vehicle to do? So that's the muscles in a human body. So you want the brakes to apply, or you want to steer the vehicle. Those are the examples. So I think we continue to make progress in each one of these as the volumes grow. For, let's say, the camera, LiDAR, radar technologies maturation, cost keeps coming down. And you will see at some point that it's a balance that customers are willing to pay for new technologies initially, and then as it matures, you get more and more higher volumes and the cost keeps coming down.
And then do you think that a fully sort of virtual certification of ADAS, or for that matter, maybe even an autonomous vehicle someday, do you think it will ever be possible to certify these technologies virtually without any physical testing?
Yeah, being the simulation kind of guy, I think it is always our vision to mature the simulation technology to that level. You might take a while to get to the SAE level 5. That's where the levels come into play. But on some of the other feature functions, over a period of time, you will see some of that would be possible in a shorter period of time.
I'm sure the companies building these technologies would be happy to hear that outlook, because as you mentioned, it's much more cost effective than doing physical testing.
That's right. And the road is not a glorious road. There's a lot of investments in doing that physical test correlation, taking care of all the noise factors or the other variabilities, and building that confidence. And then in this case, would be also bringing the regulators along with you during that development journey. So they are part of it. And so they can build confidence that what's being done in a virtual environment or a simulation environment, they can go through the assumptions which are being made. They can do the testing around the confidence levels at each stage, at each level, and then get to that point where you can do the certification.
And then when it comes to the simulation, maybe the simulation engines, you mentioned two aspects being machine learning and artificial intelligence, and then also the fact that they're physics-based simulation. I was hoping you could maybe describe how each of those aspects kind of feeds into building these more and more sophisticated simulations.
So with the advances in computing power, I think that is what is allowing all the other technologies from an application standpoint. So the physics-based model is that when you have a sensor model on your vehicle, it is not simply reflecting from the city infrastructure a computer gaming model, versus you have a model of the real city and the properties of the building or the roads or the trees built in those models. So that's what is a physics base. So when there's a signal going hitting that building, when it's reflecting and coming back, it is not just a imaginary graphics purposes, a gaming engine. It is more of a what's really happening in that environment. And you can do that computation. That means you need to build a huge models of the city infrastructure, as well as all of the different materials, the different possibilities of hitting these at different times of the day, where the sunlight is, what the reflection scenario is. And so you can imagine that that's huge. In terms of machine learning, and artificial intelligence comes into play in a lot of those building up those scenarios. So when you're driving around what we touched on previously, what we call the corner case scenarios, you could have sensors while on a vehicle, while running on a road, collecting all this information, and they're feeding that information back to the cloud infrastructure. And then comparing that into what the baseline is. And with that, they're doing self-learning and recording, and they keep getting better as they come across other scenarios. So that'd be a good example of how the machine learning plays in the self-learning and adapting to the different scenarios, and then using that information for the next possible development in the vehicle environment.
And so you've talked about comparing between the simulation and the physical environment, and how using those comparisons or the correlation between the two, you can continue to build up the accuracy or at least your confidence in the simulation. Does machine learning help accelerate that process?
Yes, machine learning. There are several scenarios you can create. Machine learning is in a simplistic way, nothing but you observe the previous scenarios, and instead of just the human looking at it, the machine learns in terms of zeros and ones of that information for a given input, what the outputs were, making it very simplistic. And you create enough scenarios or enough iterations that your database is strong enough to handle the next set of scenarios. So the next scenario you feed in is has never happened in a physical environment. It's just a virtual feed. And based on the previous learnings, the software will tell you what the outcome would be. And that's where you build the confidence now you can rely on that because you've had enough learning by feeding in all the previous information. That is one example of machine learning.
So the next, maybe we can kind of pull back out to the industry level view. One thing that's been notable with the development of autonomous vehicles is the emergence of some potentially unusual or unexpected partnerships. I think one notable one was that Mercedes and BMW announced they would be co-developing some autonomous technologies. So what do you think is the impetus between these partnerships between what you would otherwise think of as fierce competitors?
Yeah, there's a couple things. The challenges are so huge, and there is a, so to say, skill set shortage, and everyone feels the need to get on and make some progress. And then also it's expensive. Even when you do have skill sets available, it's very expensive to build the teams with those skills and the infrastructure needed, whether it's the computing infrastructure or the testing infrastructure, et cetera. It's huge. So companies are forming all kinds of partnerships so that collectively they can leverage what's, so to say, common from a technology standpoint, doesn't interfere with their competitiveness from the IP standpoint, intellectual property standpoint, and they build these partnerships with the hope that they can, both of them and these partnerships can progress. You used one example, and you'll see several of them with the technology companies and an OEM, between two OEMs, example you used, and one good one is Volkswagen, Ford, working with Argo AI, doing a common investment. That's how they're going to mature their autonomous technologies. Hyundai working with Aptiv, that's another good way of seeing two different aspects coming together to deliver the autonomous vehicle technologies. So you see several of these, but the common driver is speed at which both partners want to progress, and also they don't want to be left behind on delivering autonomous vehicles. So those are some of the reasons behind. And obviously, at the end of the day, it all has to make a good business sense to make these partnerships successful.
And you mentioned the skills gap or the kind of the lack of the necessary skills in the sort of automotive industry. Do you think this is an area where other technology companies can, it gives them a bit of an advantage perhaps as they try and get into the vehicle space?
Definitely. I think the technology companies have done a huge amount of transformation within whatever part of the business they are in, whether it's software or whether it's artificial intelligence. It could be in telecommunications. It could be in purely the Facebooks and the Googles of the world, right? So they have a very strong foundation in technology, and it's all software driven as well. So what's common in vehicles are becoming very software centric. Automobile, you could say, it is becoming a software on wheels to some extent, or it's your IT infrastructure on wheel because there's so much computing power and so much software available. So in an autonomous vehicle example, you will have software, what's called the embedded system software within the vehicle. You'll have software for infotainment, and you'll have a software with connectivity to even to do your shopping scenarios within the vehicle because you'll have a vehicle talking to Amazon as an example. So as you can see, it is a common element. And the second part is the technology companies see that automotive industry, especially the way it is shaping up, as connected and a business on the wheel is a predominant industry and is a good business case. And so they're bringing not only the technology, but their money as well to invest in and for future. So I see a huge advantages technology companies have, and that becomes a big challenge for a traditional OEMs, because some of the technology companies are not coming up with any legacy issues, whether it could be the labor related, whether it could be the current employees related, etc. They are, so to say, relatively fresh. They are last 20, 30-year-old companies versus a 100-plus-year-old companies. So they bring in a lot of challenge to the traditional OEMs because they have a new way of thinking, out-of-box thinking, new way of doing things, and they have experience in the technology part of it, which is these two fields, automobile and technologies, almost all come together.
Earlier we were talking about, or maybe I think it was perhaps last episode, we were talking about over-the-air updates and the potential availability of add-ons almost, where a customer could purchase additional capabilities or features for their vehicle. This is an area where, if you think about a mobile phone example, you have Apple with the App Store. That's maybe something that they have experience maintaining that could be a huge advantage in developing some of these new automotive business models.
Definitely. You used a very good example. So how many times when you get a new iPhone, you had to take it to a local dealer to get something done? No, it's so user-friendly. These things happen behind the scene. Most of the time, updates are happening while you're sleeping late at night, right? So to them, it is a very natural because they've been doing it for years. For automobile over-the-air update, you know, very few companies are doing today. And every time it's a big news, right? I'm sure when we touched on, we say Tesla, that's a big differentiator, but obviously others are catching up, but it's still a big deal. It's not that easy as your iPhone getting updated and nobody even notices.
Right, because of course, an update on a vehicle, you have to make sure that it hasn't somehow impacted any of the other maybe more critical software, like one that runs the emergency braking system, for example.
Right, absolutely. So the safety vehicle is different than your iPhone. You could use that analogy that it's not the same as updating an iPhone because there's a safety factor and you're driving and you've got vehicles in there with the people, etc. But when you look at pure technology angle, then you say, well, it's a software update, right? You just need to obviously put extra security, extra checks of making sure it's not interfering with the systems. But from a technology standpoint, there are a lot of similarities.
So then moving on, I think certainly everyone recognizes that level 5 autonomy is still a ways off in the future, but is, of course, the end goal for a lot of these companies. What can we do in the current environment with, you know, the technology available today? What can we do to push the boundaries of autonomy and continue to develop the technology?
Yeah, so the progression to these levels, that's one approach, that you go from level 2 to level 3. I'm not even talking about level 1 to 2 because, as I said, that's been done, so to say, for a good chunk of the companies, that you continue to mature. But there are four things in my mind, and technology is just one piece of it, that technology needs to continue to grow, enhance, making sure the security and the safety is paramount, and you can start addressing maturing of that technology. The second important point is about the business model and the business case, that when we are doing these things, making sure autonomous still delivers profits for the companies and also delivers value for the users or the consumer. The third and the fourth factor of bringing in a shift and a change of the level of autonomy if level four or level five comes into account is the legislation and the policymakers. Making sure, and those are big deals in my mind, if you put as a percentage of each factor, because at the end of the day, if something does go bad, who's responsible for it? Who's accountable for it? What are the legal implications? All those things make a big, big factor in terms of the policies and the safety and the security, et cetera, are the factors which will drive how we speed up this from level three to level four and someday from level four to level five. Also, from a pure technology perspective, there might be a shift of technologies as well. The current technology approach of growing one by one level, there might be a newer set of technologies in the works, which will jump directly to level five vehicles, and it might offer a different set of technologies to be used. I think some companies will come up with those ideas as well, and that's yet to be seen. How practical will that become? So those are some of the factors in there. But that is a holistic picture, not just purely a technology or a user business case, and combining that with the policymakers, combining that with the certification homologation, keeping that in mind. And this is where you see a little bit of the variation when you take a global look. Some countries will take that leap and they will adapt these levels of autonomy sooner than the others. Some will take chances because all these other policies and legalities are different in different countries and different parts of the world. And that's where you see another big variation, that you always have to have that global viewpoint in mind, not only a holistic, focused only on one area.
So it's not just a question of technological advancement. It's also a question of society being ready, I suppose, to accept and use these vehicles.
Yes, it's the society being ready and everyone else supporting the society, what role they are playing. For example, education is one of the big things, right? When you go take a ride in an autonomous shuttle, which you can do that in Las Vegas here, right? A few shuttles running around. When you experience that for the first time, you have a different opinion versus once you've done it 10 or 15 times. So that all becomes part of the education. Society in general, I've come across a few interesting scenarios. How is normal population behavior in general? In other words, you will see autonomous vehicle will have a flashing light telling pedestrian it's an autonomous vehicle, and people will pay attention to that. And it was an interesting scenario shared in certain parts of the world. People will see that there's an autonomous vehicle and they want to jump in front of it, just trying out, would it really stop or not? Now, you and I will never think about that in the U.S. Let's try it out. Now, that's the education part, right? That's in certain parts of the world, people are more gutsy. They say, yeah, I understand it. Let me see if it works or not. They don't worry about the consequences just in case it didn't work, what will happen? So these are little interesting examples you see that there are so many other factors, not just the technology.
That seems like a very high stakes gamble to take for very little payoff.
Yep.
So getting back to the technology side, however, one aspect, or I suppose a potential approach that we've heard about, is the idea of remote monitoring of the vehicles. And that being a way that could bring us closer to the level four and level five. What do you think is the value in that approach, and what are the challenges involved?
Yeah, definitely. So these are all the scenarios of geofencing. How do you go from level three to level four? And geofencing is that you define an environment, and remote monitoring, you could have one of the environments. So advantages you have in there is ultimate goal. One of the goals is you don't have to have a driver in the vehicle. So they'll allow you to do that. So that's a big plus. On the other hand, if there are situations which vehicle is having some difficulties, by remote monitoring, you can address those and sometimes even control those vehicles remotely. So it gives you a safety net, so to say, in that environment. So now you're pushing the technology into an autonomous level. You're getting advantages off the what the goal, one of the goals is, and then still making sure there's a safety net before you let it loose completely. And that's where I think the legal part might come into play and the policy by different country. Some country might allow that, okay, you don't need the remote driver after you've been driving for X number of months or years. Other countries might say, nope, I always want you to have that backup.
That also brings up the aspect of security. And this is probably even true with connected cars today of, you know, how do you ensure that the remote monitoring system or the over-the-air update system are secure and, you know, not vulnerable to outside actors?
Definitely a huge issue in terms of making sure it's addressed before anything gets, so to say, practical in terms of the mass distribution of these type of vehicles. So the safety security starts to come into from the very basics of software development for these vehicles. So there are new compliance methods and standards being put in place, for example, for software. ISO 262 compatibility to assure the software is going to work and to some extent of security as well. And then a lot of the regulations and procedures around cybersecurity, they play a big role. And not only at the end state of application and usage, but also during the entire development process, making sure the on all steps along the way, that thing is taken into account.
And then do you think the geofencing and remote monitoring, is that a plausible way of maybe kind of lowering the barrier to entry, I suppose, for autonomous vehicle deployments, making them easier to get achieved?
Yeah, definitely. It is a way of achieving that and also making people comfortable with it. You talked about society and providing advantages. Several cities have come up with dedicated lanes for electric vehicles, autonomous vehicles kind of thing. That could be one of the ways of making sure that people are starting to get comfortable and they see some advantages as well. It's just like in LA, your carpool lanes, that kind of setup.
So then speaking of kind of the society perspective again, how can we push forward the development of regulations and legislation? It's an aspect that we've mentioned a couple times as being really critical to the actual adoption of EVs. So are there practical steps that can be taken to kind of improve, or maybe not improve, but enact policies around autonomous vehicles?
Yeah, I think collaborating and working with the standards organization, for example, again, SAE International, where I've spent quite a bit of time in leadership roles, plays a very important role in setting up those standards and implementation of those, and then working with the government agencies through SAE could be one good example of how these things could be continue to be enhanced and bring to reality. I'm sure there's other parts of the world or other standards organizations like ISO, and then in Asia Pacific, there might be the local authorities having their own standards organizations. That's one way of approaching getting the legislation building bodies, letting the policymakers engage through those processes and making progress on that.
So then we've also talked, of course, about technological development. And the other aspect to that is the, as you've mentioned several times, the business development. How are maybe business challenges either accelerating or holding back these emerging trends of autonomy and self-driving vehicles?
So I think business trend is always central to making any technology available for masses. So at the end of the day, today, people are willing to pay for that technology, but that's a, so to say, much smaller percentage who can afford to pay higher pricing. You used the example of Tesla before, right? And it is a little bit more expensive than the traditional vehicles, but people are willing to pay for it. And now what you want is grow that number of people or the volumes so that these technologies become available for the masses. So that happens in two ways. One is grow the economies of scale. Someone needs to continue to invest in the technologies and mature them to a point that you have a, both from a manufacturing standpoint and a production standpoint, you grow the economies and the cost curve keeps coming down. That's one big factor, which will bring these to fruition.
Then the other aspect is the development of city infrastructure for helping autonomous vehicles navigate within, you know, dense urban environments. How the development of those technologies plays into this?
Of course, we touched on not only from an autonomous perspective, but also the connectedness and a multimodal transportation. All those become part of the connecting to the cities and the city infrastructure. It becomes a very important part for the autonomous vehicles. So if you're pulling into a restaurant and your vehicle is fully autonomous or even a level 4 autonomous, that the self-parking or some of the companies are offering the feature called valet parking, I think what a convenience to have, right?
Yeah.
It's pouring hard or it's snowing and you're done with dinner with your date and all you do is push a button on your cell phone and when you walk out, vehicle is sitting there waiting for you, all warmed up, heated, and there you go. You pull in and go. You don't have to turn your ticket in to the valet guy and you don't have to worry about waiting there in the cold, etc. So you see how the city infrastructure in this case could be the parking structure nearby, the restaurant owner and the customer going into that, into an autonomous vehicle, having the network connectivity, whether it's 4G or 5G, the mobile phone is able, it's confident, it'll be connected all the time. Now you've got the entire chain built. And then you don't have to worry about driving late at night in the dark either, because your vehicle is autonomous and it's going to bring you home safe.
Yeah. Are there good examples of companies that are leveraging these infrastructure technologies in deployments of autonomous vehicles, even experimentally?
Yeah, you will laugh again, right? The Tesla is doing, I think, valet parking. They're bringing it and people are starting to use it at a consumer level. Some other companies I've seen from a research standpoint have been doing it for years. The valet parking example, that you stand by your door and you push a button and your car comes to you. So now it's just a matter of maturing this to a production level technologies.
So then, Nan, the other major automotive and transportation trend often mentioned last in the kind of list of different trends is the idea of shared mobility or mobility as a service. How critical are autonomous vehicles to this concept, or is shared mobility or mobility as a service something that will bring autonomous vehicles into the mainstream?
So mobility as a service, there are several aspects, but obviously autonomous vehicle play a big role in some of those scenarios. And good example to use is a shuttle service within a city running all the time. That would be autonomous. And a shuttle of, let's say, at airport terminals running from one end to the other end is shared vehicle. There's multiple people in it. So those are some of the good examples of shared mobility and mobility as a service. Autonomous plays a big role. You can also see the rental car model changing. You rent a car, and if it's autonomous driven, it gets delivered to your home, and you take it where you need to go, and you send the car back when you're done with it. So those are all very good practical examples of mobility as a service and the shared mobility, in addition to all the delivery capabilities, whether it's delivery of a Amazon delivery truck or a drone, or a delivery of a pizza from a local pizza store. Those are some of the things some of the companies have already experimented. So I think, huge topic on its own, and I'll love to talk about it next time.
Autonomous vehicle development is well underway at many of the largest automotive companies in the world, as well as several startup manufacturers and even major technology corporations. We already have vehicles on the road with self-driving capabilities. For now, these systems are limited to either specific driving scenarios, such as highway driving, or to specific geographic areas in which their environment can be more easily controlled. As development continues, these capabilities are sure to expand. Verification and validation of self-driving systems continues to be one of the most daunting challenges for companies on the road to full autonomy. There are practically infinite unique situations an autonomous vehicle may encounter on real roads, and that's especially true when they're sharing them with human drivers. While no approach can account for all of these, using a combination of simulation and real-world testing has become an important strategy for ensuring the safety and reliability of these systems. Such an approach allows automakers to test their systems under a much greater number of scenarios, and for a fraction of the cost and time required to do it with just physical testing. Now, successful deployments of autonomous vehicles will certainly go beyond just the technology. The industry will need to work with several levels of government, from local to national, as well as industry standards organizations to develop policies specifically for AV operation in the real world. This will prove critical as the technology advances from levels 3 up to 4 and 5. Taking this all into consideration, there is clearly a long road ahead for those aiming at the goal of truly self-driving vehicles. But, as a point of encouragement, those people are not alone on the road. By working together with partners both within the automotive industry and beyond it, we can make the most of our time and effort and step ever closer to the future. Thank you again for listening to our series on the transportation revolution. I'd like to extend a big thank you to Nand Kochhar for his time and expertise. Up next, we have an exciting new series on software and systems engineering and how it is leading to a process revolution in the automotive industry. So we'll be exploring more about model-based systems engineering and how it can power automotive businesses into tomorrow. Thanks again for listening, and we look forward to welcoming you back on the Future Car.